You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Catherine the Great by Karen Valby, with photographs by Art Strieber, styled by Rebecca Ramsey. The trajectory of O'Hara's life changed forever when she was a teenager and her older brother started bringing his girlfriend, Gilda Radner, to dinner with the family. "When Radner came over," says O'Hara, "my mom would definitely break out the good plates." Inspired by Radner's acceptance into the original Toronto cast of the musical Godspell, O'Hara auditioned as well. She got a call back, but not ultimately a place in the show. "That's okay, it's fine, still bitter," she jokes. O'Hara did, however, get to observe the cast members backstage: Eugene Levy, Victor Garber, Andrea Martin, and Martin Short among them, and it lit a fire of possibility. She recalls seeing Short in Godspell for the first time. "I took the program home, and I remember kissing his picture because I thought he was so adorable, and dating Levy very briefly years later. I think we went out to breakfast once. I think we must have kissed, but nothing further because he was a gentleman and I'm a good Catholic girl." More than all that, she remembers Radner treating her like an adored younger sister. "She had me sleep over one night, and then in the morning we sat there at her little kitchen table with a pretty cloth," says O'Hara. "We had tea and pumpernickel bread with cream cheese and cucumbers." You come from the suburbs, something like that is so cool and chic and exotic. When O'Hara turned 17, Radner gifted her a book of 17 coupons bearing promises like, "I'll take you shopping and I'll do your hair." Still, the actor is quick to disabuse me of the notion that she must have been special to have been loved so well by her friend. "No, seriously, that wasn't about me," she says, shaking off the suggestion. "Every one of my family will have the same kind of stories. She was like that with everyone." Before long, O'Hara followed Radner to Toronto's Second City improv troupe, serving initially as her friend's understudy. "Gilda wore a lot of funny hats and glasses, so I did the same." She also watched Radner, who died in 1989, bring lovability to every role, no matter how absurd or deranged. This, of course, is precisely what O'Hara has been doing for years. "Everyone has been in love with Catherine since she was 17, says Short. "No one made me laugh like her on stage, and she always brought a humanity to her characters. They always had a bent reality, but they were never not kind." Toronto's Second City troupe went on to do 6 seasons of the Canadian sketch comedy show SCTV. They've all stayed friends forever, and Martin Scorsese staged a reunion in 2018 to start shooting footage for an upcoming Netflix special. Lately, they've been gathering around O'Hara's Island, working on new material and telling stories about beloved friends long gone, like Radner, John Candy, and Harold Ramis. Candy, who starred with O'Hara in Home Alone, died in 1994. "On O'Hara's birthday, as it happens, oh, it was terrible," she says. "I got some mixed phone calls that day. Happy birthday, and oh my God. Yeah, I'll always remember the day he died." A Canadian TV interviewer once asked Candy why his friend O'Hara didn't work more often. Did she even want to be a star? "I don't think Catherine wants to play the wife," Candy said. He went on to describe how O'Hara turned down Beverly D'Angelo's role in the National Lampoon's Vacation movies because she didn't see the character. Next photo, blown away. O'Hara using a leaf blower around the cement areas of her yard. O'Hara left Canada for Hollywood in the late 1980s, not for her career, but for love. She had fallen for production designer Beau Welch on the set of Beetlejuice. The couple married and raised two sons, now in their 20s, who are employed as a set dresser and in set construction. Both sons worked on Schitt's Creek to give you a deeper sense of how dreamy the gig was for her. I know that doing SCTV really opened the doors, O'Hara says of her first years in L.A. Chris Columbus and John Hughes didn't make me audition for the mom part in Home Alone. I met with them, and I guess I was close enough to the character somehow, or they just ignored what I was like in the meeting and hired me anyway. O'Hara remembers running into her co-star Macaulay Culkin a few years ago. I opened my arms and said, "Baby." Culkin called her mom and fell into them. O'Hara insists that early on she routinely flubbed auditions. She describes meeting with a Canadian network head about a comedy show and the executive asking if she did any characters. I told him, "Oh yeah, lots. I do a woman who's lost all her teeth and she talks really funny, and another woman who's always mad at her husband, so she's got this kind of angry voice." She wraps her head with her knuckles. I described them, and bad descriptions, too. Warming to the theme of her own screw-ups, O'Hara says that she was desperate to play the Holly Hunter role in Broadcast News, and that James L. Brooks called her after her first audition to tell her how amazing she was. After blowing the second audition, O'Hara wrote Brooks a letter. "I know how I blew it," she told him. "Please let me go again." So he called her in for a third audition, and then a fourth, with one of the stars, Albert Brooks, which seems to have been a disastrous chemical misfire. On the way out the door, O'Hara remembers James Brooks stopping her and asking, "What happened to you?" The third and final entry in O'Hara's Tales of Terror is the most adorable and possibly the most revealing. She auditioned to play the wife in a Robert De Niro movie. The casting people ask her to read a scene set in bed, so O'Hara slid down in the chair, trying to seem like she was lying down. She recreates it for me on her kitchen chair, her chin tucked unflatteringly into her chest, and her legs stretched out akimbo. Really attractive, right? Yes, it may have been a poor choice. But as Candy said, she didn't actually want to play the wife. We could have used a lot more of O'Hara over the years, but with Schitt's Creek, she gave us everything. The actor spent enough time at SCTV and in Christopher Guest improvised movies to make collaborating with Eugene and Dan Levy feel like a homecoming. She was so sure of the boundaries of what the character would and wouldn't do, says Dan Levy. O'Hara came up with Maura's vague European parlor accent, as well as her obsession with wigs. She also elevated the character's grande dame vocabulary into the stratosphere of absurdity, with words like unanimous. Unanimous is fun, the actor says with a laugh. It means equally stupid, as in, a number of unanimous ideas have been put forward today. Most of all, O'Hara insisted that Maura and her husband Johnny, played with such elegance by Eugene Levy, remain in love throughout the crisis that finds them owning, operating, and living in a shabby, forgotten motel in a town they once bought as a joke because of the name. Theirs is a deeply romantic story of a man thoroughly enchanted by his mercurial wife. Rewatching Schitt's Creek now, as many have been doing for comfort and escape, Moira suddenly seems like all of us forced to live in a terrifying new life that resembles nothing of our past one. Moira is unapologetic about hating every second of her new normal, even as she grows closer to her family and her better self. It's hard to conceive of any other actor managing to make Moira as dear as she is outrageous. When I ask O'Hara if she kept anything from Moira's closet, she disappears into her bedroom for a minute and returns with a divine pair of black lace-up Givenchy platform booties in one hand and an armful of luxury draped over her other arm. The Michael Kors sequin shift that Moira wore to her son's boyfriend's coming out party in season 5. A Celine tuxedo and a McHugh Alexander McQueen coat. "And look at this dress," she says fondly, holding a slinky above the knee item out in front of her. "Apparently I love Givenchy. It's really tight, but in a good way. How many older women get to wear short dresses or skirts? I did, as Moira." In the days leading up to our visit, O'Hara admits that she felt a little adrift. "At one point last week, I was feeling grouchy or something," she says, "a little disturbed. Every once in a while, it hits me." This is the time of year she'd be leaving for Toronto to start anew on Schitt's Creek. And now it's done. "I don't see trying to top this," says O'Hara. "How greedy can one person be?" "When I was growing up, my mom would say, every day, just be thankful for your health. Get up and be grateful that you're awake. You're here for another day." It's against O'Hara's practical nature to fantasize about goals, but she admires the hell out of Melissa McCarthy. She's so funny and fearless and such a great actor, and is riveted by Succession. The actors and the writing are all so good. Everyone's despicable, but you love them one moment. And the next, they're awful again. Her plan for now is to write for herself. She won an Emmy for writing for SCTV, and if she's going to work, she wants to feel devoted. "When I do take a job, I work really, really hard," she says. "I forget that I'm a wife, that I have a husband and kids. I'm completely there. I think talents are God-given, and it's your job to take care of them and share them with the right people." And she stops and gives herself a magnificent eye roll. Blah, blah, blah. Next photo, home alone. O'Hara is floating in the pool on a chaise wearing a fur coat and swimsuit. Last year, O'Hara was nominated for her first lead actress in a comedy Emmy for Schitt's Creek, and it was the first time a stylist dressed her for a red carpet. She and Eugene Levy were determined not to let her slip into the sweaty desperation of her For Your Consideration character. O'Hara wrote an acceptance speech just in case. She says when she's nervous, she can't be trusted to remember her own name. But lost the speech. True to form, she's gracious about it. "The only thing I was bummed about was that I didn't get to do my bit, which I thought was funny. I swear, it's not about not getting the award. It's, oh, I had such a good bit." Before we say goodbye, I beg her to share the bit with me. She looks horrified and waves her hands. "You can't share a bit," she says. "It's bad form, and it could still be usable. In case I get another chance." quiet on set. Over 5 days in March, the multi-million-dollar machinery of television production ground to a halt. Showrunners, crew members, and executives recount the week that everything changed and try to imagine the road back, by Joy Press. Additional reporting by Anthony Bresnican and Joanna Robinson. Opening photo, the Before Times, the Law and Order Special Victims Unit set during the 18th season. And Clocked Out, the Law and Order SVU Squad Room, set under wraps. By March 6th, Rikers had started to feel dangerous. Law and Order Special Victims Unit is filmed on a soundstage at Chelsea Piers in Manhattan. There are sets for the courthouse, the interrogation rooms, the district attorney's office. But what troubled showrunner Warren Light that Friday was the replica of a Rikers prison cell. It's a windowless, uncomfortable room, and it doubles as a holding area for the many background actors who populate NBC's crime drama. If we're doing a courtroom scene, says Light, we might have 100 extras in there. The large cinder block hallway outside the cell seemed problematic as well, because it also functions as the show's catering area. Everybody eats the meals together, so they're on the line, one person after another, taking the big spoon and dolloping stuff onto their plate, says Light. And also you're passing equipment back and forth, props back and forth, costumes back and forth, makeup. We were all obsessively washing hands, but I walked by Rikers and I thought, this is scary. At the time, there were only 44 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state of New York. The city's hospitals were not yet besieged, the morgues not yet overflowing, the air not yet pierced by near-constant sirens. But Light had read enough to know that the pandemic was galloping toward them. On Monday, March 9th, he proposed what had previously been unthinkable, shutting down production. Later, he would learn that showrunners from other studios had gotten a similar reaction initially. That first day, he says, I was met with derision. Television shoots operate with tight safety restrictions. Even if you're a writer who's sitting in a chair behind the camera, you will get sent home by the safety guy if you have open-toed shoes, says Light. But the invisible nature of the virus made it difficult for executives in Los Angeles, as well as people in virtually every other walk of life, to wrap their heads around the threat. Light explained that most of his crew rode the subway to work. This is an outbreak waiting to happen, he said. One beloved SVU crew member, costumer Josh Walwork, went home early that Monday, not feeling well. He later died from COVID-19. The week of March 9th upended the television industry, just as it upended everything else. Over the course of 5 days, the intricate multimillion-dollar machinery ground to an unprecedented groaning halt. At the start of that week, many had been oblivious to the danger. On the Monday, Vanity Fair asked the showrunner of a popular prestige drama whether the outbreak would interfere with his show's upcoming shoot. The showrunner seemed befuddled by the question. He'd been so busy that COVID-19 had barely impinged on his consciousness. Others flinched at suspending production, which would cost millions and inflict unemployment upon crew members and actors. As Americans of every kind began contemplating the ever-increasing prospect of contagion and a quarantine with no clear end, the television industry scrambled to figure out how it could keep turning out entertainment for a world voracious for distraction. There was no roadmap for how to proceed. And what executive wanted to be the first to make such a drastic move? so production chugged on. Series and pilots continued to shoot around the country. As late as Thursday, March 5th, the day after Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency in California, HBO held a lavish Hollywood premiere for the third season of Westworld, where attendees gamely fist-bumped instead of hugging. "Look, it's not real till it's real," says veteran film and TV producer Christine Vachon, who was filming Halston, Ryan Murphy's forthcoming Netflix series starring Ewan McGregor, when COVID-19 came to town. "So you have hand sanitizer around, and you wrap your craft service snacks in plastic, and all of those things. It was the feeling of, okay, we can still shoot the show. Nobody's telling us we can't, so we'll do everything to make people as safe as possible." The industry had dealt with forces beyond its control before, of course. Julie Plec, mastermind of the CW series The Vampire Diaries and Legacies, and co-writer of the forthcoming Netflix political drama The Girls on the Bus, says she initially assumed that working around COVID-19 would be like making contingency plans for snowstorms. "That's happened to us several times over the last decade, where you were looking at the weather, trying to decide if the snow is going to hit and when it's going to start," she says. The anxiety level of the crew can get to a point where, even if it hasn't snowed yet, we send them home because it's not worth the risk. In Chicago, showrunner Noah Hawley was deep into the fourth season of FX's Fargo with Chris Rock. Hawley had arrived on set on March 9th to direct an episode, only to discover that a crew member of the upcoming Fox show Next had tested positive. Some members of that crew had since joined Fargo. "We sent everybody home who had worked on that show first thing," says Hawley. "And then there was the scramble for information. Who was it? Were other people feeling sick?" After talking to executives, he gathered the team to tell them what he knew. "Everyone was really unsettled by the news," Hawley says. "We had a prop master whose girlfriend had worked on that other show, and we ended up sending him home just to be safe. But it did raise a lot of questions that were hard to answer, like, what's the level of exposure at which the risk is deemed too great?" Gloria Calderon-Kellett had begun doing risk analysis for her pop TV series One Day at a Time, even before March 9th. One of the show's stars, Rita Moreno, is 88 years old, and in late February, as they prepared for the season premiere, Calderon-Kellett began to worry that the actor would be in peril if she traveled to New York for a talk show. "I went to her dressing room and I said, 'Hey, listen, I know these are huge opportunities for the show, but don't be a hero.'" One Day at a Time began limiting the number of people allowed on set. On March 3rd and March 10th, they filmed without the usual live studio audience, a disquieting experience for an ensemble accustomed to real-time feedback. "Is this funny?" star Justina Machado asked the few crew members present, to which the crew yelled back, "Yes, you're hilarious. We'll try to laugh louder." Intensifying matters, broadcast networks were in the middle of pilot season, producing the first episodes of potential new shows. On Wednesday, March 11th, the day the White House announced it would bar travelers from most European countries, CBS's creative chief David Nevins showed up for a live taping of Be Positive from sitcom king Chuck Lorre and his mom collaborator Marco Panette. The show revolves around an odd couple premise in which a man in need of a kidney, Silicon Valley's Thomas Middleditch, forges a bond with a potential donor, Annalee Ashford from Masters of Sex. Nevins was elated to be working with Lorre, but a stark thought occurred to him. This may be the last audience show anywhere in America, and maybe the world, for a really long time. Out of 56 broadcast pilots, Be Positive would be the only one to complete production before the shutdown. It was a magical night, says Nevins. It had the feeling of end of days. You know, that night when the ship is going down and the band is playing one last time. In early March, of course, the U.S. economy was undergoing a kind of slow-motion car crash, and there was a chasm between the COVID-19 believers and non-believers. President Trump, for instance, was still insisting, just stay calm, it will go away. In the TV industry, the divide may have been compounded by a kind of macho, tough-it-out attitude among crews. Everybody prides themselves on being a workhorse, says Light. It's pouring rain, and it's ice cold, and you sit outside for 12 hours. And if you can't do it, you don't belong with us. In TV, as in all walks of life, it became difficult to tell what was real and what had been exaggerated. You'd hear that somebody was coughing on set, and others would say they didn't feel comfortable, says Jeremy Gold, the co-president of Blumhouse Television, which at the time had series in production for places like Showtime, Amazon, Hulu, and CNN. Is that a real thing? How serious do you take that? We were in constant huddles, and with each new piece of information came another decision about how to act. Gold says the famous line from Jaws, "We're going to need a bigger boat," began looping through his head. At every turn, this kept getting more dire and more dangerous. Bruce Miller, showrunner for The Handmaid's Tale, was shooting season 4 in Toronto, with Elizabeth Moss making her debut as a director. When he discovered that someone in the production might have been exposed to COVID-19 on another set, then, locations where the show had planned to shoot began to shut their doors. Filming became impractical pretty quickly, says Miller, and we knew there would be a straw that broke the camel's back. An actor doesn't show up or can't get into the country. As international borders started closing, Miller also worried his actors might have trouble getting back home. Around the country, producers and executives conferred with one another about the escalating crisis. Inevitably, we're consulting with each other because we have co-productions, says Nevins from CBS. At first, he had hoped to make decisions on a case-by-case basis. For instance, postponing a production of The Talented Mr. Ripley with Fleabag's Andrew Scott, which was preparing to film in Italy this summer. Now something became abundantly obvious. There were going to be no clean places anywhere. Still, surprisingly little action was taken. By March 10th, as the number of known infections in the U.S. passed 1,000, only CBS's reality show, The Amazing Race, had publicly announced that it was halting production. Maybe the other networks and streamers thought that the show was an outlier, that its globe-hopping conceit made continuing logistically impossible. And, to be fair, it's not as if the executives over at the movie studios had figured out the way forward either. On March 10th, Disney went ahead with a red carpet premiere for Mulan, gathering 3,400 people inside the Dolby Theater in L.A. Wednesday, March 11th, was a turning point, however, not just for the television industry, but for America at large. The NBA's decision to suspend its season indefinitely followed only minutes later by the announcement from Tom Hanks that he and his wife, Rita Wilson, were sick, came as a blaring wake-up call. In short order, the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus a pandemic, and the stock market fell precipitously. Finally, that same day, the CW teen drama Riverdale suspended production in Vancouver after discovering that someone on the show had been in contact with a coronavirus-positive person. As soon as that happened, everybody else felt safe to do it, says one producer, but you needed a first group to be the ones to step out. On Thursday, March 12th, as executives spent hours in meetings gaming out battle plans, the number of confirmed U.S. cases topped 1,300. Across the country, crews began rushing to complete the episodes they were working on. It's especially difficult to shut down that close to the finish line, because you work yourself up into this kind of fever pitch at the end, where you're trying to get everything, says Holly, the Fargo showrunner. Not finishing likely meant that Fargo would not be able to air in time to be eligible for the Emmys. Holly, nevertheless, called his executives at FX and MGM to tell them they needed to pull the plug. And between lunchtime and late Thursday afternoon, the mood had shifted to the point where no one argued. Everyone understood it just wasn't going to happen. We had to shut down. The next day, Holly learned that someone on their Los Angeles post-production team was symptomatic, so those staffers were sent home to self-quarantine. Suddenly, I couldn't even edit the show, he recalls. It is amazing how quickly we became paralyzed by events. A cascade of shutdowns followed. By Friday, March 13th, the day the U.S. declared a national emergency, and Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti announced the city's schools would be closing, American television had effectively come to a dead halt, hurling hundreds of thousands of people out of work. It all ramped up so fast, says Rachel Schuchert, a writer on the Netflix series Glow. The week began with people avoiding hugging or touching each other. By Friday, we were told we're shutting down. Not everything went into hibernation. A few series, like The Crown, rushed to finish episodes in progress. Late-night hosts quickly returned to the air, finding entertaining ways to shoot from home. And many writing staffs for scripted series transformed themselves into virtual writers' rooms on Zoom. The writers of Netflix's animated series Big Mouth began congregating virtually that Friday. Co-creator Nick Kroll also recorded cast members' voices from their homes. Maya Rudolph is recording in her living room, and so her kids are popping in and out of frame, which is so fun and sweet, says Kroll. But since the show about the miseries of puberty occasionally gets graphic, he found himself having to warn his star, "We're about to do a scene you may not want to have your children in the room for." The writers of The Walking Dead also quickly converted to working online. It's kind of ironic to be writing about the apocalypse in the middle of the apocalypse, says writer Latoya Morgan. The team had spent an inordinate amount of time discussing survival tips without knowing one salient fact, that we actually could potentially need them in our real lives. Meanwhile, companies struggled to figure out how to safely complete post-production on shows that were nearly ready. Equipment for editing and sound mixing were delivered to some staffers' homes before offices closed down and Los Angeles's shelter-in-place order was issued. "We're going to see how inventive everyone can be," says Blumhouse co-president Marcy Wiseman. "Most people want to be inventive because they want to work." Hollywood executives had been anxiously anticipating a very different kind of apocalypse. The threat of a writer's strike in May, when an agreement between the studios and the Writers Guild expired. That's one reason the new short-form streaming service Quibi had already squirreled away enough scripted content to last until Thanksgiving. But the production shutdown still disrupted its unscripted Daily Essentials series, which meant shifting the set for the music show Pop 5 into host Tim Cash's garage, and the gaming show Speedrun into host Jimmy Mundell's living room. Friday the 13th was the day in which it was, okay, this is no longer going to be business as usual, and if we don't instantly pivot, we're not going to make it to the finish line, says Jeffrey Katzenberg, founder of Quibi, as well as a former studio chief at Disney and DreamWorks. On a personal level, that instant pivot proved far easier for those in the industry's upper echelons. while executives, writers, and other employees who work in offices quickly transitioned to working at home, TV crew members exist in a gig economy. Most can't do their job virtually, and few were paid for more than a few weeks after productions shut down, if at all. "I'm really nervous that this could destroy me financially," says one showrunner's assistant. "When people think of Hollywood, they think of stars. But for behind-the-scenes people, it's a blue-collar job, and everybody's scared." Although assistants have been checking in and making care packages for each other, she says, "I don't see higher-ups checking in with people on my level. It's almost like a caste system where the higher-ups communicate with each other and don't feel the need to reach out to the people that help make their lives easier." Someone who has a $10 million overall deal with Netflix, they're going to be okay. The below-the-line people are just totally screwed. The relief fund for Hollywood support staff, created by the group #PayUpHollywood, quickly raised upwards of $500,000, buoyed by contributions from top-tier showrunners like Shonda Rhimes and Greg Berlanti. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, many of whose 150,000 union members have lost jobs in the shutdown, committed $2.5 million in donations to three entertainment charities. Netflix, too, pledged $100 million for those on their own halted productions, as well as nonprofits providing emergency relief to the industry. But with so many television workers staring into the void of long-term unemployment, the division between haves and have-nots continues to rankle. TV executives can't predict the future any better than anyone else, but this dramatic pause will almost certainly transform the way television is made. Which improvised and ad hoc solutions will end up becoming the new normal? Only time will tell what's an innovation that is better, cheaper, faster, helps the comedy, helps the storytelling, helps the intimacy, and what is just a temporary adaptation out of necessity, says Nevins of CBS. Calderon Kellett of One Day at a Time has been talking to other showrunners on social media, trying to imagine what a return to normalcy might look like. "What would need to be in place for you to feel like your crew is safe to return to work?" she asked, adding that she can't imagine moving forward without the ability to test for the virus daily. "You think Rita Moreno is going to step on the set if she doesn't have 100% assurance? It's not worth her life. Nothing is." Miller, from The Handmaid's Tale, says he's been pondering ways to make a television show or a movie with only 10 people working together at a time. It's a very interesting challenge. Even for those working from the safety of home, it's a strange exercise to try to imagine the post-quarantine future. "I was doing a rewrite yesterday," says Julie Pleck, "and I thought, oh my God, the world is going to change completely as a result of this experience." You can't write a movie set in 1946 without acknowledging that World War II happened back then. What stories are we going to tell now? And how are we going to acknowledge what we've all just been through? You're writing present day without really knowing what the present day is going to look like.
Thank you.
solo acts, 12 of TV's most arresting actors, share their screens, stories, and stay-at-home secrets. Interviews by Caitlin Brody and Brett Hennemuth. Photo shoot directed by Jackie Nickerson, styled by Samira Nasser. In 1999, when The Sopranos electrified pop culture, people wondered if TV could maybe someday be as engrossing and artful a medium as the movies. It's hard to imagine that kind of naivete now, but we were also freaking out about Y2K. Vanity Fair asked a dozen actors whose performances have impressed us this year to collaborate on photo shoots that would both celebrate the ever-higher peaks of peak TV and chronicle this unnerving moment of self-isolation. Here you will find Sarah Snook, whose turn as Shiv Roy in Succession is a delicious portrait of a woman who wants her vicious father's approval so much that she is almost willing to become him. You'll find Zoe Kravitz, who delivers a magnetic career high of a performance in High Fidelity, as well as taking on executive producing and writing for the first time. You'll find Julia Garner, a stunning badass on Ozark, whose work has become deeper and more vulnerable than ever. To create this portfolio, all the actors worked with photographer Jackie Nickerson over Zoom. These standouts, and their peers across the industry, have given us all an arguably life-saving gift, a great reason to stay inside. Josh O'Connor, The Crown. "I'd quite like to borrow Highgrove House, Prince Charles's residence," says Josh O'Connor, who portrays the royal landowner in Netflix's The Crown. It's pretty big and has famously beautiful gardens, a fairly lush spot for isolation. In the meantime, O'Connor seems to be nurturing his own green thumb. "I've been starting most days with an hour or two in the garden. It feels like the most peaceful place to be." The series' fourth season made the cutoff before production halted, promising fans an on-time release. As for the real prince, he's recovered now, thankfully, and I imagine he's spending much of his time gardening, like me, actually. Oh, dear. Julia Garner, Ozark. Julia Garner has had a whirlwind year. In September, she won the Emmy for her turn as Ruth Langmore in the second season of Netflix's Ozark. And in December, she married musician Mark Foster of Foster the People. With both of their hectic schedules on hold, Garner is enjoying the slow pace of domestic bliss. "I clean my closet to Lil Wayne, and Mark has an amazing studio where he'll start with one instrument, and a few hours later, it's a full song." Garner has taken to cooking and is soliciting recipes from her Israeli mother, mussels and shakshuka, and making key lime pie. For now, she might take a page out of her character's book and rewatch Scarface, but she's yearning for a post-quarantine outing to a proper movie theater as soon as possible. Sarah Snook, Succession. In a far cry from her character Shiv Roy, Succession's reigning ice queen, Sarah Snook, is eager to return to the normalcy of her warm and fuzzy self. "I'll never take a plain old hug for granted again," she says, from home in Australia. "I haven't had any physical human contact since I hugged my sister goodbye in Papua New Guinea more than a month ago." But Shiv, whose perfectly tailored season two looks and glow-up bob have inspired endless internet fodder, does have something Snook wouldn't mind getting her hands on. "Maybe I could have just half of her liquid wealth and redistribute it to the people who actually need it," she says. "Besides that, I'd borrow her pants." Uzo Aduba, Mrs. America. "I love pajamas," confesses Uzo Aduba. "Mostly my La Sera white nightgown, floaty, open, and has pockets." You're welcome. The Emmy-winning queen of comfort may be relaxing to R&B and jazz for now, but in the streaming stratosphere, she has traded Orange is the New Black's prison system for the equally corrupt political arena as real-life Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm in Hulu's Mrs. America. In addition to leisure wear, Aduba has a recommendation for dining after quarantine. Café Le Luc in Brooklyn. They have the best pancakes in all of New York City. I said what I said. Patrick Stewart, Star Trek, Picard. My principal solace for years has been jigsaw puzzles, especially those of paintings I love, says Patrick Stewart, who is on pause from reprising his role as Star Trek's favorite admiral in the CBS spinoff Picard. I have just finished a great Frank Stella, and a Da Vinci awaits. Despite having spent much of his professional career saving outer space, it appears Stewart and his wife are thriving at home. I enjoyed doing the photo shoot over Zoom, but not as much as my wife, Sunny, who was camera operator, set designer, and costume dresser, a new career. Though Stewart confesses he misses the joy of visiting a hardware store most, he might be longing for a bottle of his character Chateau Picard wine more. He'd make sure it's always drinkable. Zoe Kravitz, High Fidelity. I've been making some bomb breakfast burritos with black beans, eggs, and avocado, says Zoe Kravitz, of her morning routine while self-quarantined in London. During this time, the star and executive producer of Hulu's gender-swapped adaptation of High Fidelity has learned to cut her own hair, indulged in regularly scheduled virtual coffee dates with Fidelity author and screenwriter Nick Hornby, and, of course, has been listening to music. Buena Vista Social Club, George Harrison, Stevie Wonder, and Questlove, something of which her record shop-owning character Rob would certainly approve. One other thing Rob would love? Kravitz's itch for the character's signature leather jacket. I have basically stolen everything else from Rob's wardrobe already. Rami Youssef. Rami. Quarantine has forced Rami Youssef to get extra creative to complete season 2 of his self-titled series, Rami. He's already the creator, writer, executive producer, and star of the semi-autobiographical comedy about life as a millennial Muslim American, but circumstances have raised the bar on the finishing touches. There's always extra audio that happens after a show is done shooting, says Youssef, who earned the Best Performance in a Comedy Series Golden Globe for his first season. But with castmates quarantined around the world, we've sent microphones to capture audio, and our entire editing and finishing process is happening over FaceTime and Google Docs. At least Youssef is staying comfortable through the chaos. His pièce de résistance? Sweatpants. I don't even know the brand. They're just those sweats you have, you know? Your mom bought them for you. They're probably from an airport gift shop or something. Pamela Adlon, Better Things. Just like her character in Better Things, the FX series Pamela Adlon created, writes, executive produces, directs, and stars in, the Emmy winner has been cooking for her 3 daughters while quarantined at home in Los Angeles and dropping off homemade meals for her mother, who lives across the street. I hope with all my heart that we don't go back to the way things were, says Adlon. I think this was the universe giving us one last shot to get our shit together in terms of how much consumption goes on in the world, the amount of waste, and how we treat people and the environment. We can clearly see who and what has truly become essential. This is a wake-up call. Daisy Edgar Jones, Normal People. It seems fitting that the female lead of Hulu's Normal People, the adaptation of Sally Rooney's romantic literary sensation, has been spending her days in a contemplative way. I have a little terrace which gets some sun, says British actor Daisy Edgar Jones. I'm currently growing carrots, strawberries, cornflowers, and sunflowers. I didn't think seeing the first little shoots would be such a thrill. It's not quite Glastonbury, but you've got to get your kicks somewhere. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.